Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day. All right, and it's day three of Behind the Knife's live coverage of the 2016 11th Annual Academic Surgical Congress. The meeting's winding down today, but we have some more great stuff coming for you today. We have Dr. Hayter is going to talk to us about disparities in trauma. We have an international guest, Dr. Hill, who's going to talk to us. He's a colorectal surgeon, talk to us about some ERAS protocol stuff. And then we have Tim Pollock, who's going to talk to us a lot about the ASC and what the ASC has done for him. So all that and more coming up today. We've had the privilege that Dr. Dimmick and the ASC has been very gracious to us that are allowed us to record some of the sessions here for, you know, people who can't make it. There was a great talk yesterday on called Failing Forward, where it's short TED style talks about from some great surgical leaders about times that they had failed and how they were able to turn it around and turn it into success. So we'll be releasing that sometime next week, so we can look forward to that. So all right, without any further ado, let's get to Dr. Hayter. Okay, welcome back. We're lucky enough to sit down with Dr. Adil Hayter. He's a trauma surgeon. He is the Kessler Director of Surgery and Public Health at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and he's also the Deputy Editor of JAMA Surgery. Dr. Hayter, thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, and it's been a great academic surgical congress, and it's been really nice to get to know the three of you guys.
Well, thank you very much. If you could, for just for our listeners, just give us a brief background, where you come from, what you do, where you did your training.
Oh, my pleasure. So I'm a Midwesterner. I was born in Ohio, grew up in Indiana, and then for a significant period of my life, I had the pleasure of living in Pakistan and attending the Aga Khan University Medical College, where I really saw, what happens if you go to a place where there's a scarcity of resources, and where even though society seems homogeneous as far as people, the way they outwardly look, there is an enormous difference between the way people treat one another and a significant difference in, socioeconomic status, where some people have a lot and some people have nothing. And then from that experience, I had the pleasure of coming to Johns Hopkins to do a master's in public health and then go for residency at New York Medical College and Westchester Medical Center, where I got some very broad training in general surgery. It was fantastic, five very great developmental years. I moved back to Hopkins for a couple of years, did fellowships in trauma and acute care surgery, and then had the pleasure of staying on staff there for a significant number of years before coming to this last position.
So one of your main lines of research is healthcare inequality, especially in trauma. And hearing your experience in Pakistan, is that where you kind of became interested in this?
You know, if you look at my med school essay, I'll talk about, and I remember it really well still, I talk about in there about how, you know, some people have no access to healthcare and what a grave problem that is. And during residency and then, even the early part of my fellowship, I expected that my career would be working in global surgery and helping providing surgical care across the world. I had the privilege of going to work in South Africa and Eastern Africa as well, and had amazing experiences there. And then when I came back to Baltimore, and this is around 2005, 2006, to continue my fellowship, my mentor at the time, Dr. Cornwell, who remains my most cherished mentor, we were chatting and he said, you don't need to go to Africa to take care of poor people. They're right up the street. And he couldn't have been more right. We are the greatest nation on earth and in history, and we have been blessed with enormous resources. But the fact that we have situations where people don't get the kind of care they should because of either where they live or what they look like is unacceptable. And as a society, I know most, if you ask any American, they'll say, people shouldn't die from cancer because they can't afford treatment. I'm sure everybody would say that. We just need to figure out a way to make that happen.
So I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit. You know, you're really credited with establishing the field of trauma disparity. About the summit, the NIH, the ACS summit that happened in May of last year. If you could give us a little background and how that came to be, and if you could define kind of the scope of the problem that that summit was supposed to address.
Sure. You know, healthcare disparities have been known for a long time. You know, it's been more than 30 years ago since the first report came out, and then maybe more than 10 years ago where the IOM report on unequal outcomes came out showing, talking about disparities in healthcare in general. However, most people expected that if you go to the emergency room, there would be no difference in the treatment you'd get. That, you know, we don't check anybody's insurance, you come right in, and you're going to get the best possible care. So people assume that trauma is immune to disparities. And all of us kind of believe that.
But there
was some data potentially suggesting that minority children who, for example, fell off a, just to make it easy, fell off a swing in a playground and were in the inner cities, they would come to the hospital, they would get different treatment versus a kid in the suburbs who may be white, and fell off a swing, and then people would observe them longer or get them a CAT scan and so on. So there was some suggestion. So when we did our first analysis looking at pediatric trauma back in 2006, we found that for children who had significant brain injury, for those children, we looked at 7,000 patients, we found that black children ended up having a greater inability to walk, talk, and eat at discharge after traumatic brain injury. So essentially, their functional outcomes were worse than their white counterparts. Now, this was very controversial when we first started it, right? It was very controversial. In fact, well, the first time I presented this, and you guys can imagine, this was at the American Association for Surgery of Trauma. I'm a fellow presenting the work. You know, you can imagine how, you know, stressful that is. And one participant in the audience really got upset to the extent that the gentleman started to scream, "Bullshit, you can't say this kind of stuff."
Wow.
At a large national meeting. And, you know, of course, there were letters to the editor written that, you know, Dr. Heider and his colleagues should be stopped from pursuing this line of research because it's an insult to, those of us who take care of trauma patients. But our response was, and I really got to credit my partners, Dave Efron, Eddie Cornwell, Elliot Hout, you know, they were like, look, we're a diverse group of, you know, we're different, we're, all of us, we're different races, different religions, and so on. And we took care of predominantly minority patients in inner city Baltimore. So if there was anybody we were questioning ourselves first, right? Our next study looked at disparities in outcomes after trauma, and this used the National Trauma Data Bank. We used some, great statistical modeling, and that's why I got really involved with statistical methodology to really try to do the best possible job because this was such a sensitive issue. We really wanted to, you know, seek the truth. And what we found was that if you are a, that it's not all about just being black or white, and that insurance plays a great role as well. So compared to a white insured person, a black patient with insurance, again, is about 20% more likely to die. A Hispanic patient with insurance, about 40% more likely to die. But a white insured versus a white uninsured, okay? So same skin color,
right.
50% more likely to die because they didn't have insurance. And if you don't have, and if you're a minority and uninsured, even more. So about 80% more likely to die. And so with this backdrop, you know, of course, again, this was something that really raised a lot of eyebrows and, you know, and it wasn't just us. We did this work and then several places, and I was at Hopkins at the time, colleagues from where I work now, Center for Surgery and Public Health, Atul Gawande, others, published a lot of literature on this, really showing that this is true, that even in this trauma. And therefore, we then put our work towards understanding the mechanisms that lead to trauma disparities. And over the past several years, that's what we've been doing. And just to wrap up your what you asked, what we've been doing is we've been spending a lot of time last few years to understand what are the underlying mechanisms that lead to it. And just very briefly, you know, there are certainly differences, you know, potential differences in how we treat one another and how we end up, and that may impact how we treat patients. But probably the most important thing that we found is where you're injured and where you get taken. So some hospitals have better outcomes than others. I mean, we know this from quality, right? From all the quality work, you know, some hospitals have great outcomes. And it just happens that the hospitals that have probably the worst outcomes also end up taking care of the most minority patients. And you can understand why that happens. I'm not casting a doubt on those hospitals. Those hospitals are tough places to work. They have very high uninsurance rates, don't have the resources to invest in, you know, being able to do better, improving quality. And so that's what we're finding, that a lot of it has to do on geography more than anywhere, anything else. And so the NIH conference you mentioned was on the backdrop of all of this foundational work of first showing disparities and then trying to understand what the mechanisms are.
Now, sir, is there anything being done now to narrow that gap in racial disparities? I mean, what are the, you have all this good research and it's great. And now what are we doing now to, are we still doing more research? Or are we trying to do, what's our next step?
So that's what that conference was about. So what the American College of Surgeons, much to their credit, have created a committee on healthcare disparities. Actually, they first started with a committee on optimal access and then realized how broad this was and created a committee on healthcare disparities. And this was all the way from the top, from the Board of Regents and President and Executive Director and so on. Dr. L.D. Britt has been instrumental in making this happen along with Executive Director David Hoyt. And they really wanted to help develop a solution. And in fact, they put out a statement from the American College of Surgeons saying that, you know, you can't have quality of care without access to care, right? And they supported a conference at the NIH. And of course, the NIH is a great research arm. Their department of their National Institute of Minority Health and Disparities, the NIMHD, the director and the Director of Extramural Affairs, Dr. Irene Donkel-Mullen, you know, we all got together, and the ACS, you know, supported this to help people travel, and the NIH helped organize a conference of 50 to 60 leading scientists from around the country who do healthcare disparities. So now, over the past 10 years, there are many, many people who do this kind of work. And what they did is that over 2 days, they looked at all the data available on healthcare disparities and came up with an agenda of what needs to be studied. And they basically created five different tracks of what needs to be studied and where we need not just studies, but interventions. And then came up with research questions and potential intervention ideas. And all of that work is going to get published in a forthcoming journal in, I think, almost next month. It's coming out.
How does the disparities in trauma compare to some of the disparities in other parts of healthcare? Is it greater than the disparities in maybe primary care or cancer? What is the thought on that?
Well, you know, the scope is different. You know, if you talk about primary care, one could see where a lot of disparities come from, right? So, for example, you know, you don't get plugged into the right clinic. And then even if you get plugged into the clinic, your appointment is very much delayed. So, for example, you know, somebody did a great study where they took a kid, okay, we love children, who has asthma, and tried to get him an appointment with an allergist, and basically had the exact same story, except gave the kid Medicaid versus private insurance, and showed how difficult it was for the Medicaid person to get in, right? So yeah, I mean, it was a great, awesome study. In trauma, you think that, you know, you can come right in. But then what actually happens to you in the hospital and the kind of hospital you get to is a major issue. And so I don't think you can say that we have more disparities than others. It's just the scope and the way the disparities work are quite different. I'll give you one example. One major problem we have is where patients go after discharge. So if you don't have insurance, think about the issues with getting rehab.
Yeah.
You know, Now one great thing that as a country we've done is to do a better job taking care of our veterans. I mean, if you go to the, first of all, these guys and girls totally deserve it, right? I mean, they go to go overseas to take care of all of us. And when they come back, we need to do everything we can and give them the best possible care. And luckily, in many instances, they do get that. That, you know, if you go for the Center for Intrepid and so on, you're going to see these amazing things with prosthetic care and so on that are, Armed Forces veterans get, which they absolutely deserve. But then you go to people who, you know, your guys' ages, get in a car crash, have some bad output. If they don't have insurance, the kind of prosthetic they can get, the kind of things that, the rehab that they get, very much dependent on their ability to pay. We can do better than that. We can certainly do better than that.
Well, certainly a very complex problem, and I'm sure we could spend a lot of time unpacking it. I know you have to run. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, and we would love to have you back on the program for a longer full-length interview at some point.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I completely agree. Healthcare disparities is a complex topic, but you know, you asked me when I started, you know, the first part of the interview about you know where I grew up and so on. Let me just say this. When you live overseas, you can see how unequal society is, right? And how, you know, what the problems are. But in America, we have come so far, and we have achieved so much in creating our more perfect union. And these are things that we can fix. You know, we just need to, you know, pay attention to it. And that's been the brilliance of our society, that when we don't just say, oh, well, there's no racism, there's nothing, just look away. We say, you know, there's a problem, and let's see how we're going to make it better. And that is the reason why we remain the greatest nation and will continue to be the same.
Awesome. Dr. Hayter, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Continuing our theme of capturing people in the halls, we're absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Timothy Pollack, who is the Chief of Division of Surgical Oncology and the John L. Cameron Professor of the Alimentary Tract Disease. Also done very interesting in your background with all the different fellowships that you've done, fellowship in medical ethics, done a master's in theology, the director of the liver tumor. I literally think I could go on and on and on. And is it true? I did a very quick PubMed and I saw 537 citations. I couldn't find another Dr. Timothy Michael Pollack out there. That's pretty incredible for your stage in the career. So welcome to BTK.
Thank you very much.
So. Our theme here, obviously, is in Jacksonville, is the Academic Surgical Conference. Can you talk a little bit about what it's meant to you through the years and the importance of this particular meeting?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is really one of the highlights of my entire year, this the Academic Surgical Conference. It's just a phenomenal meeting. It's a great meeting. It's a large meeting. I love it because lots of young people come. For many people, this is the first time that they get to present on a national stage. We heard a high school student present today, cool. Medical students, you know, people who are in the residency, and then faculty. And it's just a great place for people to come, to present their work, to do it in a forum that is very welcoming and supportive, yet also very inquisitive, and people get a lot of questions. And I think not only do they have the opportunity to present their work, but after leaving here, because of all the conversation, I think really their work has improved, and they really add to the body of science and surgery and in medicine. So I think it's a really, really fantastic meeting.
Looking at the schedule, is there anything, any talks that you're particularly excited about or particularly looking forward to?
Yeah, so I think I always really enjoy hearing both the presidential speeches from the SUS, so this year it'll be Sharon Weber, and then from the AAS president, Justin Dimmick. I think those are always great talks because these are opportunities where real leaders in American surgery get to go a little off script, if you will, and not talk about maybe about surgery or medicine or a disease-specific topic, but really kind of give us a slice of life and how they view academic surgery, how they view you know, mentorship, leadership, and I always really enjoy those talks. The other thing I always love is the medical student abstract contest. I think, again, it's always so fun to see young people come and present for the first time and see how excited they are to present their work. I think that's also a real big highlight.
Do you have any fond memories? Give us one or two or something that you can look back on or remember your first presentation or anything that you gave at this particular Congress?
Yeah, I mean, I have so many fond memories of this meeting. Definitely, I can remember my first time presenting at the ASC meeting and the AAS meeting. Back when there was actually slides and you had to put them into a carousel. Just the excitement but yet trepidation of presenting and then just remembering all the very supportive, you know, older surgeons who were very good to me and supportive of me, and I think really helped set my career off in the right trajectory. And then more recent fond memories is just all the time you spend down in the coffee bar or the regular bar with the residents and the fellows and the med students, going over their talks before they give them, and just taking them through slide by slide and working with the young guys. And I just think that's really rewarding.
So we've been rounding out each one of these short interviews with the same question. If you could go back in time and meet yourself on your first day of surgical internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
My piece of advice would just be, you know, follow your passion. You know, it's hard to get where you're going if you don't have a destination. So I think, you know, really spend more time, I think, being introspective about what you want to accomplish in surgery, in medicine, and in your life. And if you have a better understanding of what's going to make you happy and feel fulfilled professionally and personally, then I think your mentors, and I think that's another big point, is try to identify appropriate mentors as early on as possible, then we as your team of mentors can help you achieve that. So that would be my kind of pearl of wisdom, if you will.
So to all the listeners out there, just as a little preview, we are very excited to have you coming on a full-fledged episode in the upcoming weeks, and it's truly amazing what you've done at your tender young age. And in talking about that balance in terms of not only the personal side, professional side, but in and out with time management skills. And so thank you for agreeing to that. And this was just a little taste. And thanks from all of us here at Behind the Knife.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Awesome.
Okay, Behind the Knife, back at the ASC meeting 2016. We have with us Dr. Andrew Hill. He is one of the SUS international guests at the ASC meeting this year. He is a assistant dean and professor of surgery at the University of Auckland. Dr. Hill, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Jason. So Dr. Hill, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you trained, and what you do?
So I'm a colorectal surgeon. I'm a little bit different from most people because I trained entirely in New Zealand and then spent time in some different sort of places. So training in New Zealand's a little bit different from here. We have a six-year medical school program, so you go straight from high school. And then I spent 2 years as what we call a house officer, or you would call an intern, and then a year as a junior surgical registrar, and then I got onto the training scheme. That was pretty much as fast as you could do it. And our scheme was 4 years long in those days. And during that time, I spent 2 years across, actually I did spend some time overseas, I spent 2 years in America at Boston doing a research fellowship. And then when I finished residency, as you call it, we just call it training, went off to Africa and worked in Kenya for 4 years. And then came back to New Zealand in 2002 to work as a colorectal surgeon at a place called Middlemore Hospital in the southern part of Auckland.
What did you do in Kenya, sir?
I was a missionary surgeon there.
Okay, were you pretty busy?
Most of the time, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you do mostly general surgery or, you know, everything?
Yeah, general surgery and the most traditional form of general surgery, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm interested about this this couple of years you spent in Kenya.
How did, 4 years, actually.
4 years. How did that come about? And how did you get involved in that, get interested in that, and how did you end up there?
Well, I'd always felt that I was going to be a missionary right from during medical school. My parents were missionaries and Indonesia and Hong Kong, and then that was always just part of what I thought I was going to end up doing. And I did my medical elective. Do you have medical electives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did my medical elective in a little place in north central Kenya, and then met and married my wife, who was also wanted to be a missionary in Africa. And we ended up in this hospital about an hour outside Nairobi for 4 years. And That was a good place for me because I wanted to be an academic surgeon and I wanted to practice in that sort of environment. And that was about as close as you'd get as a missionary because the hospital took interns and I did a little bit of research there, not very much. But
well, one of the things we wanted to focus on today is, and I should mention that Dr. Hill has a rather extensive research portfolio with over 150 peer-reviewed publications, but a good portion of your work has been in improving abdominal outcomes after surgery and the enhanced recovery after surgery protocols. I was wondering if you could go into a little bit about your work in that, and maybe for our listeners, start very basically, explain what the ERAS protocols, the idea behind them, and what the goal of that is.
Well, when I came back from Africa, the felt need at the hospital was that I would be a colorectal surgeon. So I went and did some colorectal training at the Auckland City Hospital, which had a fellowship program. And I did that for a while and then came back to Middlemore Hospital. And there was a guy called Henrik Kellett, who's actually spoken at this Congress. He spoke yesterday as the British Journal of Surgery lecturer, who was a surgeon from Denmark who started publishing these extraordinary results for time in hospital for colectomy. So at the time, you know, people having a colectomy would quite commonly be in hospital for around about 10 days, have a nasogastric tube and urinary catheter, and you'd sort of do this kind of mystical listening to the bowel sounds and decide, and you give them a few sips, and then, you know, and it went on, and people would lie around, they get DVTs and pneumonias, and anyway. So I heard about this guy, Kellett, and he was sending patients who'd undergone a sigmoid colectomy home after 2 days, and I thought, that's extraordinary, and I looked through his protocol, and it was all stuff that I'd always thought was kind of a bit rubbishy anyway. I mean, like he said, you didn't need to put a nasogastric tube in, and I never quite bought that anyway. And he said you could take the catheter out early, and I'd always thought that sounded pretty sensible. And then they used epidurals, which our hospital actually used quite a lot of, and he gave patients a bit of steroid before surgery, and he got them to up and about, all sort of things I'd always thought quite sensible. So there was only two colorectal surgeons in the hospital at the time, so both of us decided that we'd try to implement this protocol, and we just had a simple little protocol, and nothing happened. And I couldn't quite understand this till I heard the nurses talking to my patients one day, and I was learning along the lines of, Dr. Hill says you'll go home in, you know, 5 days, but actually you'll be in here for 14. And guess what? The patient was in for 14 for no particularly good reason. And I realized we needed to change the nurses' attitudes. So, and that wasn't the only attitudes we needed to change, but so I took them across to Kellett's hospital in the, well, when was it? Late 90s or something. The mid-2000s, and took them across there, and the nurses came back absolutely convinced, and things changed overnight. So we went from a day stay of around about 7 days, which is actually pretty good at the time, to a day stay of around about 4 to 5 days. And in fact, my own personal day stay was 3 days for colons, and it maintained that for a long time. So ERAS, or Henrik Kellett called it fast track, but ERAS was what the sort of more trendy term became, or enhanced recovery after surgery. And it was all about, you know, getting rid of the nonsense that we would, you know, the old stuff that wasn't really true, applying evidence-based surgical practice, decreasing surgical stress, and having protocols to take sort of the bespoke nature of it all out and letting doctors and nurses focus on things they're good at.
I'm curious what your routine is now for, say, a sigmoid colectomy. Are you guys using Interreg? Are you using bowel preps, pre-op antibiotics?
Avilmapan. No, we don't use Avilmapan. Oh. So if you fast-track or enhanced recovery patients, ileus is almost gone. You'd hardly have it. So we're actually revisiting our whole ERAS protocol right now. But until recently, there was a whole bunch of things that you didn't do, all the things I've kind of talked about, and a whole bunch of things you did do which were probably more, which were just as important. So it's very important you get patient expectations right up front. So we would have a long chat with people about what the deal was and try to give them a day that they would be expected to go home. That's very important. Then we gave patients preoperative carbohydrate. We didn't give them bowel prep, although we usually gave them some sort of enema beforehand just to make sure you put a stapler up. We would let them take clear fluids up until 2 hours prior to surgery. Initially we were using a lot of transverse incisions, but our department's moved, as everybody else has, more towards doing laparoscopic surgery. And we were initially using epidurals in everybody, which had to be working before they left post-op, or whatever you guys call it. And so it was very important sometimes the anaesthetist for us to recite them. The next day, that night we'd actually feed people. They would take something to eat if they wanted to, but most importantly they got a little protein drink thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you guys use. We use Ensure Resource or something
Similar.
That. They're supposed to have four of them a day. Next morning we'd have it up and about. We'd actually take the Foley out, even while the epidural was running. And we'd get them to try and eat more. The second day after surgery, post-op day two, we would take the epidural out, but make sure they had lots of oral analgesia on board. Try not to use opiates at all. And then day three or day four, depending on how things were going, we would aim to get them home. And then we would bring them back a week after surgery. Then we'd take their clips or sutures out and make sure that everything was gone well. So those are the sort of gist of it. None of it very complicated, but centred around having a protocol, mobilising and feeding early, and making sure people weren't sore. Laparoscopy screwed all that up because although people are quite sore for a day or so after surgery, the epidural just seems like way overkill for small wounds like that.
Mm-hmm.
We've added a whole bunch of other little things, like we now give a high-dose steroid. We're using intraperitoneal local anesthetic infusions. Tested out statins, but they didn't make any difference. It was disappointing. We haven't incorporated chewing gum. We don't believe it works in that context. A lot of people like using chewing gum.
Yeah.
But we've done a meta-analysis on that. It doesn't seem to make any difference.
Well, you know, the ERAS protocol or the fast track has been a great example of using evidence-based medicine to, you know, further surgery. Is there anything else that maybe you're currently working on, or a topic in surgery or procedure that you could maybe foresee that this protocol-driven a treatment may be applicable?
Well, we've done it in bariatrics, and that's really good. The place that's really fantastic is in orthopedics, and I don't do any orthopedics, but we have an orthopedics floor right below our one, so we've done, and I've had some orthopedic residents who want to do some research, so we've done some stuff with them. So we're doing stuff in, and we're doing some other stuff now in some long-term care. So, for instance, bariatric patients, about 18 months after their sleeve, they often put on weight. So we're doing some work with text messaging systems for them. We've moved towards trying to refine discharge criteria because, as you know, well, for your country, readmissions are a big deal. For us, you know, readmission, don't like them, but they don't cost us anything. Well, they cost the country, but they don't cost surgeons or hospitals anything. And so we've been using CRP to help define who can go home, and then we're further refining that, attempting to refine that using a variety of different cytokine or biomarkers. So we've got a big study going on that at the moment.
I know one of the problems that we run into is when we try and do these enhanced recovery protocols, everybody will be on board with it, and we're doing great, and then the nurses shift the ward that they're working on, the residents shift the rotation, and we have a whole new team come through, and then we're starting over from zero, or the protocol doesn't gets deviated from. Have you run into this problem?
And everybody runs into that problem. I don't know why it is. I mean, why are we still teaching at medical school, at nursing school, old stuff? For instance, why does every resident who comes to me, even though I've written on it and it's known for a fact, tell me that a fever on post-op day one is due to atelectasis?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where does that come from?
That's cool. It gets reinforced every year on standardized tests.
Yeah. It's cytokines.
Yeah.
You know, it's nothing complicated. And where do these messages come from that you need to have a nasogastric tube down, mm-hmm. or you can't eat and drink, or you can't mobilize? I don't know anybody who actually thinks that's a good idea, to overload people with fluid, starve them till their anastomosis is cured, maybe some 6 weeks down the line. You know, where do people get these ideas from? Or that you just load people up with opiates? I don't know.
I guess that kind of leads into my next question is, are we at a point now where, you know, these, and I think the answer is yes, where these protocols, the ERAS protocols, should be almost standard of care. They should be written in the textbooks. It shouldn't be an individualized thing.
Well, I think we should stop calling it ERAS. Let's call it modern perioperative care.
Excellent point.
Mm. It's like the term lap collie. You know, why do we use that term anymore?
Just call it
collie cystectomy.
Yeah, good point. Anytime we have an international guest, I'm always just curious to learn about what is your screening protocol for colorectal cancer in New Zealand right now?
Oh, well, we have had a pilot thing going. It's all to do with money. Mm-hmm. So I've had a pilot study going on using fecal occult bloods on what we call the North Shore of Auckland. And as usual, it showed a fair amount of benefit. So the talk is about breaking that out across the country. Because it's too expensive to do, you know, the way people might like to do it, in other words, starting at a lower age and having the test very sensitive, we're going to probably make the test a little less, or, you know, stiffen up the targets and do it on a few older people to start off with. So, yeah, we're just behind the pack. Typical New Zealand sort of thing. We sit and watch, see what happens with everybody else. It seems to work, and then we get into it.
So right now it's a fecal occult blood test somewhere in the 40s or 50s?
No, it's a bit older than that. I'm not sure. It's a bit in the 50s or, yeah, late 50s, early 60s. I can't remember exactly.
Okay, sir. Well, that's been great. And, you know, we've been asking all of our guests the same question at the end. If you could go back to the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
don't take it all quite so seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really important. I think, you know, I was always in a hurry and always in a hurry to get anywhere. You know, and it's encouraged really in New Zealand because you finish high school and you go straight into med school. So there's no real time to sort of reflect. Mm-hmm. Then you go straight into internship, and then we actually take a little bit longer over that time than you guys do. But it's all still trying to get somewhere. We have an extra exam in the middle, called a part one exam, which is a really tough exam, sort of is your entry to training exam. And that's just, you know, it's a real hammer right early on. And then you finish and you're all in a rush to go and do stuff. And I would have liked to have met my wife a little bit earlier and then go off and travel for a year. I reckon that would have been really fun. Mm-hmm. We never did that. We traveled to Kenya, but that was also serious. You know, we had small kids at the time. And yeah. So never really got to enjoy that stuff.
Well, speaking of not taking things so seriously, I think there's a party going on downstairs, and we don't want to keep you from that. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us here on Behind the Knife. And Dr. Andrew Hill, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, and that wraps it up for us. This is the final day of the 2016 ASC Behind the Knife. We had a great time being here. We want to, again, thank the Academic Surgical Congress, thank the AAS, the SUS, Dr. Dybbuk, Dr. Weber, Dr. Hader for making it possible for us to be here. We had a fantastic time. And so everybody listening, it's a fantastic meeting. You should definitely try and get here next year. You know, start working on your abstracts now. It's a fantastic meeting.